This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. The popularity of bourbon has surged during the past decade. As evidence, just look at the number of local bars dedicated to the drink. In Bourbon Curious, a simple tasting guide for the savvy drinker, award-winning whiskey writer and Wall Street Journal best-selling author Fred Minnick creates an easy-to-read, interactive tasting journey. You can join our conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Fred, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Fred, where do you start with the history of bourbon? I mean, how far back do you go, and who gets the credit for actually creating this?
Well, this is one of the problems with bourbon, is that it hasn't had a whole lot of scholarly research dedicated to it, you know, unlike beer and wine, which has had, you know, a few decades of researching it. Bourbon's really just now catching the interest of people who study or wanting to find out who invented it and where its origins were and everything. So most of the bourbon stories out there are in fact legend. But realistically, what would be considered bourbon today was likely first made in the late 1700s, early 1800s. We don't exactly know who invented it or where it was invented, but, you know, there's some pretty good theories floating about.
What makes bourbon bourbon? I mean, we've got whiskey, we've got bourbon whiskey. What makes it bourbon?
Well, here's the fun thing. Bourbon is actually whiskey. Whiskey is a kind of a categorical term that essentially means distilled grain aged in wood. So Scotch is whiskey, Irish whiskey is whiskey, Canadian whiskey is whiskey, and bourbon, of course, is whiskey. And all of these whiskey categories have their own regulations attached to them. Bourbon's kind of, obviously, you know, my favorite whiskey category to talk about. It has to be made from at least 51% corn, so it's predominantly corn, whereas Scotch is predominantly barley. And there are a lot of other technical aspects to it, but the most important piece is that it has to go into a new charred oak container or barrel every single time. So bourbon's got kind of a cost-prohibitive nature to it, in that they can't use used barrels. And this has been like that for a very long time. And the barrel is actually what gives it all of its color and about 75% of its aroma and flavor. So the barrel is the lifeblood of what bourbon is. And probably the third most important thing in terms of what bourbon is, in my opinion, is that it just has to be made in the United States. It doesn't have to be made in Kentucky, which is a common misnomer. It just has to be made in the United States. In fact, you know, you guys have a lot of distilleries in that area. The one on the Cincinnati side of the river, Woodstone Creek, has been making bourbon for about a decade now. So you have some nice Cincinnati history there for making bourbon.
Yeah, and Fred, isn't that one of the myths about bourbon, is it has to be made in Kentucky? But that's not the case.
That's right. I mean, it is a myth, and the reason why it's a myth is that, you know, the Kentucky distillers have been very good about promoting the fact that they make the majority of the bourbon. I mean, up until about 10 years ago, you know, that myth, you know, permeated in the likes of the New York Times and USA Today, and nobody in the Kentucky distillery community was sending letters to the editor correcting them that it doesn't have to be made in Kentucky. The fact is, when you pick up the majority of the bourbon on the shelf, it will say Kentucky straight bourbon. And when the governor goes, when the Kentucky governor, Steve Beshear, goes and talks about bourbon, he'll say that Kentucky makes 95% of the world's bourbon, the other 5% is counterfeit. So, I mean, they have some fun with, you know, staking their claim on bourbon, but there's really good bourbon being distilled in Texas and Washington and New York. In Indiana. I mean, so there's bourbon being distilled in a lot of places right now.
Yeah, even as far north as Michigan, I found it. So you're right.
It's made in Michigan. Once upon a time, it was distilled in Mexico prior to the Congressional Declaration in 1964. There was a distillery making bourbon in Mexico and selling it into the U.S. market. And that's one of the big reasons why Congress passed a declaration to make bourbon a unique product in the United States, giving it geographical protection from other countries that have trade agreements with us to not make bourbon.
So is that why it's bourbon is considered America's spirit, because Congress said it so?
Well, they didn't use that exact verbiage. They didn't say America's spirit, but in the de facto sense, it is indeed America's spirit. And there's very, like, anytime they have trade negotiations, they have to come across whether or not they have to negotiate how bourbon and Tennessee whiskey will be used in those respective markets. And all with the exception of Australia and New Zealand's trade agreement, they have taken our laws of what bourbon and Tennessee whiskey are and applied them to those countries. The exception there in Australia and New Zealand was that, you know, the law states that it can't be bottled at no lower than 80 proof. But in Australia, you'll see Jim Beam that's bottled at 74 proof. So they've got this kind of grandfathered clause in there for bourbon. It's interesting because it's the only place in the world where you can find 74 proof Jim Beam.
Yeah, bourbon's history goes way, way back, as you were talking about earlier. Didn't we actually have a rebellion in this country over whiskey at one point?
Well, you know, whiskey makers don't like being taxed very much. And after the Revolutionary War, you know, they're looking at how they're going to pay their debts. And one of the first ideas thrown on the table was a whiskey tax or a tax on, you know, spirits. You know, a lot of these distillers in Pennsylvania and Maryland were, you know, people who fought in the Revolutionary War, and they had to be thinking to themselves, why in the world would we pay a tax when we just fought for this country? And so they rebelled. And George Washington is, you know, federalizes troops for the first time against U.S. citizens over a whiskey tax. And as I wrote in Bourbon Curious, there's this incredible connection between government and distillers for a very, you know, even today. But Congress has always been involved getting their hands in the distilling industry, making it better. The Bottle and Bond Act of 1897 gives basically consumers confidence that their whiskey is not adulterated. President Taft comes out, you know, 10 years later and gives the definitions of bourbon and straight whiskey and kind of gives some nice government precedent of what it is. And then, of course, in 1964, they passed the Congressional Declaration that protects bourbon from foreign competitors. And then, you know, one of the more recent ones, it would be President Obama and Senator Mitch McConnell talking about the Bourbon Summit. What people don't realize is that when President Obama visited an Ohio facility called Cleveland Whiskey, which uses like an incubator process to age whiskey, it's very controversial. He visited a controversial whiskey facility over a Kentucky bourbon distillery. So people weren't very happy about that here in Kentucky, but it's a very interesting dynamic between government and whiskey making.
Well, how much is bourbon taxed these days?
Right now, the average bottle you would buy in a liquor store, 60% of it is taxed. So for the purposes of my ability to do math, if you go and buy a $10 bottle of bourbon, which is actually very difficult to do these days, you buy a $10 bottle of bourbon, theoretically $6 of that $10 that you just spent will go to a tax. Now, the higher that they're paying, that factors in like all the excise taxes off the still, off you know, the aging taxes, and a lot of these taxes that are extremely complicated. But on average, it's about 60% tax per bottle.
We will continue our conversation about bourbon with Fred Minnick, and you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. My guest this afternoon, Fred Minnick, author of Bourbon Curious. You can join us at 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Fred, any idea how many bourbon distilleries are out there right now?
It is growing. I mean, by the time we started this phone conversation and the time will end it, there'll probably be two applications in the federal government. I mean, the thing is there's this movement of micro distilleries or craft distilleries, and when they open up their facilities, they're trying to make something that's popular. But it doesn't make a lot of economic sense for a lot of these guys to start making bourbon because it is very hard to compete with the big boys. It takes a lot of time for that whiskey to sit in the barrel in a warehouse and for it to come out and to taste good. The small distillers that have been at it for a while are starting to release, you know, 5-year-old and 6-year-old products. And so you need a lot of capital. So what you're seeing is you're starting to see these smaller distilleries, which, you know, they're in the hundreds all over the country. You're starting to see smaller distilleries be a little bit more strategic about what they're distilling. They might be coming out with a craft gin or a really special vodka in their eyes, or they're doing, quote, moonshine, which has not been doing very well in the marketplace, or they're starting to move a lot more toward rum and brandy. So bourbon is, it because of that cost of the barrel, which, you know, to buy a barrel, a new charred oak barrel, is anywhere between $200 and, you know, $300. And so to buy a new barrel, which it's very hard to come by a barrel, you have to buy them in large stock, you know, you're already looking at an investment that will not pay off if you're wanting to capture, you know, a good market. It will not pay off until about 5-6 years. So the bourbon distilling for the small guys is a little bit more difficult than, let's say, a clear spirit.
Shaw gave us a call, Fred. He wanted to know what your three best bourbons are and the best way to drink them.
Now, this is a question I get a lot, and my mind changes all the time. You know, in the three best bourbons that you can find, like, I don't like sending people on a wild goose chase to find George T. Stagg or Pappy Van Winkle. That's impossible. But I'm a huge fan of Four Roses, and I would say go with a small batch or the single barrel. You know, that whiskey's good every time. It's really spicy. It's got a lot of cinnamon to it. And I like drinking that one neat. I mean, I typically like...
So no ice, no water, just straight.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like that. I like that straight. My next pick for you would be Elijah Craig Barrel Strength. Now, this one's a little harder to find, but you guys are in Cincinnati, where you have two of the greatest liquor stores in the country on the Kentucky side of the river. You know, just go to Party Source, they'll have Elijah Craig Barrel Strength. And so by barrel strength, it's literally just coming straight out of the barrel and being bottled. Another one that would be right there would be Booker's. Booker's is also barrel strength, it's uncut, unfiltered. I like those products with a cube of ice. If you can get one of those nice, big, round ice cubes like you would see at one of Molly Wellman's bars there in Cincinnati, I would highly recommend that. And then a third, I'll go with something that, you know, is made there locally. I'm a big fan of what New Riff is doing there on the Kentucky side of Cincinnati. And I really like that OKI bourbon. They've got an 8-year-old product that's just fantastic. And so what they're doing is, to me, they're the most impressive new distillery to come out in a very long time. They've got a very large still. They've got bold ambitions, and they've been able to take, you know, whiskey from Indiana, bottle it, and have a really cool local history behind it. So I'm a big fan of what they're doing at New Riff. So for that question, I actually gave you five, didn't I?
Yeah, but that's okay, though. we can live with that. What do you think of the popularity of these flavor infused bourbons?
I hate
cherry, maple, honey.
Yeah, I'm not a fan. I think the flavored whiskey category is one that's kind of bastardizing the market a little bit. I'm about premiumization. I'm about improving the grains, improving the barrels, improving distillation techniques. These flavored whiskeys are kind of about capturing the new consumer. Their flavor. I wrote a story once where I said that they were basically attracting frat boys.
Okay.
But I am a purist, you know, and I'm not writing the checks at these companies. I'm not the capitalist they are. I mean, they've got fiduciary responsibilities to their shareholders. And it's really that simple. People,
right, that's why they're coming out with different products. Yeah.
Yeah, and I have genuine concerns about brands that have used their bourbon names on their flavored whiskey products.
Fred, we have to run here.
Flavored whiskey. What's that?
We have to run. We're out of time. But we appreciate it. Thank you for joining me this afternoon.
You got it. Have a good one.
Fred Minnix, the author of Bourbon Curious, a simple tasting guide for the savvy drinker. He'll be here Saturday for Books by the Banks at the Duke Energy Convention Center. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our program are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Kevin Rawinski. I'm Mark Haney. Seniors are inviting targets for financial fraud because of the substantial assets they've accumulated over their lifetimes. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll look at some of the more common investment schemes criminals use to target seniors and how to avoid them. And we'll hear about a campaign to raise awareness for Keep Cincinnati Beautiful. Can one man conquer the seven summits of Cincinnati in a single day? That's Cincinnati Edition, Friday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.